Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
At the UPS store, we know being a small business owner means holiday time is still go time. Still get those orders shipped time and still re-up on stamps and supplies time. That's why this upcoming holiday, while others close up shop, we'll be open and happy to help you keep being unstoppable. Come into your local store today. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS store. Be unstoppable.
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the China Shop, home of the Bandit Traders. I'm your host, Kyle, and joining me today, I've got my old friend, Eric Smolinski, fresh off a rebrand as Outlier Trading. Eric, how you like the custom intro just for you, bud?
Dude, I miss these so much. I think my biggest frustration is that it seems like you got through it in one shot. Sometimes we catch you slipping and there's some sort of issue somewhere that you then have to reshoot. And then I obviously can't contain myself from that point forward, but,
Baba got me with one the other day. He threw on his best, like Steve Urkel voice, beat me to the punch and started doing it himself.
Welcome to the China Shop, everybody.
That's pretty solid.
So dude, what's with the name change? You changed everything from ES Invests over to looks like Outlier Trading.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea behind that is when I started ES Invests, the YouTube channel started literally about me sharing my investing experience. Yeah. ES was a bit of a dual purpose term because E-minis, the S&P 500, mm-hmm. and then also my initials. So I thought that was kind of a fun, really sad attempt at a double entendre that you might catch in like a Eminem song, but he does like triple and quadruple entendre. So mine's a very sad attempt at that. But is the overall like channel has grown a lot. The audience has grown a lot. And I wanted it to be less about me because now the way I look at it is obviously I'm a big part of it. And a big part of what I do is try to share experience, but I want it to be more about a mindset, right? Like that's the whole idea of like the outlier idea is to encourage people to think differently. So that's the background.
Well, one of those things, and this is kind of the point of what we're planning on talking about today, was stoicism. It was one of the things that I think you're real big on. And I think that's a big part of this outlier mindset that you're talking about. So assuming nothing prevents it, I'd like to talk about stoicism for most of this conversation today, if we could.
Yeah, I love that.
Did you notice in there how I threw in the reserve clause?
You did. And if nothing prevents it, which is actually a really important part of stoicism, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit more about that, actually.
Yeah.
So
what are you thinking?
So a lot of what causes anxiety or stress or problems is when you say you want to do something or you're planning on doing something, but without that qualifier in there, it makes you feel like a failure if you don't do it, I think, is kind of the main idea behind that, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's to acknowledge the fact that you have some kind of intent and then also acknowledge the fact that you do not control the outcome in that instance.
Control is like a big theme I've noticed. Like a lot of, and that's, I think the main thing that speaks to me about Stoicism is that's been a big part of my philosophy is the controlling what you can control. And Stoicism kind of gave me a framework that helped me, I think, better understand or better put down a blueprint of like how to live with that mindset in mind. I've kind of practiced it on my own, like in my own way, but didn't have the terminology. It didn't have like the actual blueprints or the exercises or a way to actually like live a life with that. And so it's kind of exciting to find something that you've been doing, but that has actually, not only has it been around for 3,000 years, but there's actually, you know, manuals for how to live your life that way. Kind of eye-opening.
It's really cool. And I think the other thing to think about with Stoicism or any of those kinds of different kinds of philosophies is that I always view them as they give you tools on how to experience and think about the world, not just something like trading. And to be clear, I actually find stuff like Stoicism translates so unimaginably beautifully to the world of trading.
Yes.
Because if you think about like what we do on a daily basis is we interact with a system that we genuinely have no control over. We have absolutely no control over what ends up happening. You can put in the best possible due diligence, have the greatest research, and something else can still happen. Like all of a sudden we can have...
Iran might launch a bunch of missiles.
Bingo. We can have Palestine, Israel, Iran deciding to have a party. And that has an impact. So I think Stoicism gives you a way to think about those things. Now, I think one of the fun things to talk about with respect to Stoicism, though, is there are elements of Stoicism that I actually think are counterproductive.
Ooh, and I wonder if it's the same ones that I think about.
And I think like anything else, a massive part of how this stuff ultimately works really depends on what I would consider to like finding a balance and to truly identify the things that you value. Because if you look at Stoicism, they value some really great core concepts, right? Like virtue.
Yes.
That's obviously the highest thing that you can pursue. And I like that. And then there are elements, though, further down that I actually think I don't aspire to, realistically, from a psychological standpoint.
Do you have any examples?
Definitely. Managing expectations. Big one. I've never seen anybody achieve great things that doesn't want more in some capacity.
You need something to drive that, right?
I've never seen it. Marcus Aurelius, even one of the Stoics that a lot of us will read about if you read, you know, Meditations, which is really a book written for himself. But even somebody like him, he still had aspirations. He still wanted more. But if you look at Stoicism kind of in a vacuum, it would talk against that. It would talk about being happy with what you have and finding the value in that, and want being a drive, like a primary driver of discourse. So Stoicism is a lot of interesting quirks like that, that I see.
Yeah. And is it so much that the want is bad? I guess it kind of depends too on how you frame it. Like if you frame it as a, I guess with one of those reserve clauses, like I want to be emperor and I want to make life better for all these people if nothing prevents it. Like that's wanting more. That's going out and having aspirations for something, but I guess it may be doing it in a more healthy way. Like if you're aspiring to things that are in line with your values, I think maybe that's kind of more of the focus of Stoicism, is trying to put the emphasis back onto that.
Yeah. And it's a great point, but I guess the point that I would throw back is that sometimes the only way that you accomplish things is if it becomes a no-fail scenario in your brain. So when we use the reserve clause, we naturally give ourselves an exit. And again, I like the reserve clause. I think it makes sense in a ton of circumstances. But sometimes I think the reserve clause pulls away the outcome.
Gives you an excuse.
It pulls away the outcome. And because if you think about it, there's a million reasons that could conceivably prevent you from doing something. So then it's a function of, well, how do we frame the reserve clause? How literal do we take it? But the broader thing I think about is that I don't actually view desire inherently as a negative trait. And Stoicism generally does. Stoicism talks about limiting desire.
Mm-hmm. The discipline of desire, right?
I think exactly. And I think a big part of Stoicism really comes down to the balance of desire. I talk about balance more and more as I think about things, because I cannot emphasize enough how much I think all of this stuff comes down to a healthy balance.
Yes.
Like, for example, sometimes I feel like you have to be entirely obsessed and give up all balance and be obsessed with something if you want to get really good at it. There's no balance if you're trying to become a true master of something. Balance is gone. But to me, that should be a temporary thing.
Right. Yes.
And then sooner or later, you can come back into balance. Mm-hmm. So it's like this strange relationship.
That's interesting. There's also more about the discipline of desire that I found kind of fascinating. And one of the virtues was moderation too. We should point that out, because I think that kind of ties in with what you're talking about with balance.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the quotes that I wrote down on here was talking about if you always get what you want, you'll never be happy with it. But then the flip side of that was if you run into whatever you're avoiding, then you'll lose whatever happiness you've earned. And I find that to be a very fascinating statement. It makes me think of things like AA, like Alcoholics Anonymous, where you are purposely trying to cut something out of your life completely rather than learning to live with it, or to, I guess,
moderate.
Yeah. Rather than moderate your alcoholic intake, you're looking to cut it out completely. And then what we see with those people when they fall off the wagon is they fall off hard because they've been avoiding it for so long. It turns into this thing now where you might as well make it worth it because you're a piece of shit and you just did the thing you're not supposed to do.
What a fascinating concept, especially with, like, as it pertains to personality extremes.
Mm-hmm.
So I would consider an addict a personality extreme to a degree.
Yeah.
So then, to your point, would something like Stoicism, would something like moderation apply? And yeah, that's like a really, really interesting idea, because I could see how moderation might not work for some personality types in some circumstances. So, like, for example, I've never tried cocaine in my life. And it's like, I'm actually pretty open to, like, different life experiences, trying things.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that terrifies me about something like cocaine or heroin, these drugs that I've heard are, like, highly addictive, is I come from an addictive family. My dad was an alcoholic, both my grandparents alcoholics, so on and so forth, right?
Right, right.
So, like, it's not just alcohol that they would be addicted to. That's an addictive personality.
Right. Gambling,
so for me, could be, I have a terrible fear that even if I tried cocaine or something recreationally, just having fun with friends, just trying something, trying an experience, that I wouldn't be able to manage it going forward, and I don't trust myself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an example, actually, kind of the same as you're outlining, slightly different context because it's preemptive, but it's the same idea, because it's like, for something like cocaine, could it be potential for somebody like me to try it but then not have a problem with it? I imagine the answer could be yes, but I also think the answer could be no. And I think when you look at substances like that, like highly addictive substances, it's the idea of moderation is fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. There's also, I don't know, there's a whole lot more to that whole thing too, because you could look at it too as in, like, maybe you don't want to try it, and that's fine. You don't have to. You don't have to try everything just because you read a book that says you should be open to new experiences, but should also not be the type of person who loses their mind if they run into it somewhere.
I see.
Like, if your best friend, like, asks you if you want some cocaine, you're like, nah, I think I'm good, bud. Thank you. You do you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And it's actually funny. I remember a big part of in college, because I was in ROTC, right? Because I was going the officer route. So they still would drug test you and stuff like that. Like, I never tried even marijuana at that point. I never tried weed. But the dudes that were in the quad next to me, I would go hang out with them. They'd be rolling their blunts, and they were actually super cool about it. Cause whenever they would start smoking, they would either tell people to, like, go somewhere else away from me so that I didn't have to leave, which was always, like, I don't know. I thought that was so cool of them. It's, like, so thoughtful that all these dudes are there trying to smoke pot. And because I can't, you know, for these reasons that, you know, they didn't bother me about it, but they literally went out of their way to make me not feel, you know, like, oh, well, you can't be here for this. You got to leave now. They literally would tell everybody else, like, go outside, go fucking smoke your stuff, then come back in.
And that's like another aspect of stoicism that I really like too, is that it's a lot of it is built upon just trying to be a good person. Mm-hmm. Like that right there. Like, how would you react to that if that was your house and you wanted to smoke weed in your house and your friend didn't smoke? Would you kick them out, or would you try to treat them the way you'd like to be treated as a guest in their house?
Yeah. And I think
it's almost like Christianity.
Well, and I was literally going to say, right? Like a lot of this stuff, as you talk about it and you realize the core concepts, a lot of them really revolve around genuinely being a good person. Even mm-hmm. if you think about most religions at their core, right? There's always yeah. offshoots and stuff like that where you got to start beheading everybody. Okay. Well, maybe that's a little extreme, but you know, if you look at most of these kinds of religions, they're typically rooted in just be a fucking good person. Like just try that.
Right. Yeah. I love that.
I had a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things that I think about with stoicism that I also go back and forth with is that of acceptance mm-hmm. and taking things as they are, because especially again, from like a Marine officer mindset, you're taught to take ownership of everything, mm-hmm. everything right. around you. Even stuff that most people, like if one of my dudes got a DUI, as you know,
you would get,
I'm going to be there with him. It's yep. fucking both of us. I didn't get the DUI, and they wouldn't necessarily NJP me or something like that. But
I bet you if 10 of your guys did, they might.
They would have a big problem. And yep. while that person is doing that, I still am highly involved in a process that otherwise I have realistically very little to do with, mm-hmm. right? I can, and this is where all the stupid military safety briefs come from, which is all bullshit, right? Like it's just that turns into like CYA, which is all madness. Yeah. Anyways, back to the point of acceptance. I think there's something to be said about understanding things as they are, but also clearly defining your ability to impact things. Because yes. I think one of the problems I see with the idea of acceptance is that it leads people almost, I don't want to call it into apathy, but to kind of inaction. And I don't think that's good. I think that individuals really have the ability to impact a lot of scenarios in a lot of different ways. But curious your thoughts on the idea of acceptance.
I really like that. I especially like, because that kind of ties in with the control too, right? I have to accept the things that are within my control and accept the things that I have no control over. I find that actually kind of freeing. Personally, it allows me to not waste time thinking about something that I have no control over. And I actually had a recent example of kind of something similar to that. I was flying back from visiting my dad in Oklahoma. I was sitting in the exit row, and I fly a lot, so it usually takes a bit to get me spooked, but there was some really bad turbulence on that flight to the point where I started getting kind of scared. And I felt that fear coming in, and I thought to myself, what do I have control over in this situation? Not much. I'm sitting in an exit row, so that was something I had control over. If something happened to the plane, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to open this door and get people out. So instead of sitting there and wallowing in fear, I just started reviewing the exit procedure and visualizing in my mind what I was going to do if something bad had happened, and that got me through it with that. But by the time I finished going through that exercise, everything was fine. Mm-hmm. But it allowed me to not freeze in fear. It allowed me to give something to put my efforts and energy into in a situation where, yeah, I should have been... That's pretty helpless to be up in the air in a plane shaking around. You know, you as a pilot, what are you going to do? Well, there's stuff you can do. You just have to find something and think about it and focus on that.
Well, and I think you highlight an important point there, which is even in general circumstances that you might not have control, there are still elements you can control, right? Yeah. So you can control how you direct that effort. You can control what you choose to allow your mind to focus on. So, and that kind of goes back to the idea of exactly like you're talking about with acceptance control mm-hmm. is that there's a bit of a balance, because if you think about the amount of control that we have, it's not insignificant. And I mean, if we pivot this to the markets, right?
Yeah.
You have no control over if the E-minis, the Russell, the NASDAQ go up or down, if their correlation is in lock, out of lock, whatever price movement happens, you have no control over that.
It was a fun exercise to sit down and think about what things I did have control over.
Right, exactly. And when mm-hmm. you look at it in terms of markets, you still control a lot. You control when you click the button. You control what you do before you click the button, what you do after you click the button. And there's a lot of elements, even when interacting with a broader system, that you generally lack control, that you still do control. And it's funny because it also helps us understand why there are traders that are able to outperform markets. And it's because we know things like efficient market hypothesis aren't fully true. Mm-hmm. And we know that there are inefficiencies, mispricings, stuff like that all over the place that you can take advantage of. So even though you can't control the outcome of any one individual trade that you put on, you can control the way that you trade. Yep. And I think that like acknowledging that balance is really, really important in the context of trading, because you could see people that get so perturbed after they put in a bunch of due diligence. They try super hard. They're reading all the financial statements. They've read all the news pieces, right? And they're pouring their heart and soul into this research that then, because Big Daddy Elon decides to put a tweet out, something goes up or down despite all of that. And then you're just like, mother, like, but the process that you follow is entirely in your control.
Your entries, your exits, where your stops are, whether you follow them, those are all within your control. And it's actually a really good exercise to sit down and write all those things out, I think.
It's honestly something I've never done. I definitely think about it, but I've never like actually exhaustively sat down and thought about, especially in a market context.
I haven't done that yet either, personally, but I have sat and thought about it quite a bit. And I think I will do that experience. I think that would be a fun one.
You would do that experience because you are a better person than I am. And that's exactly the kind of thing you would do while I would sit there and think about it and be like, well, this is a good idea, but
not necessarily true.
It'll be an idea in Eric's head.
Okay. One of the other virtues that they kind of talked about that I wanted to spend a little bit of time on was actually wisdom. Because the definition that they gave for wisdom, I thought was fucking just beautiful. Mm. Like, it's taking deliberate actions.
Rational decisions.
Yeah, wisdom is the opposite of like emotional reaction, thoughtless reactions. I fucking love that. And that's been something that I've been really spending a lot of time focusing on, is being aware of like the emotions that happen, but not acting on them. I find that if I can just recognize that they're happening, I can actually like kind of sometimes even talk to that side of me. Like, what are you doing? Why do you want to go short here? What are you thinking?
Sounds like you need to do a session with Richard.
I need to do another one with him. Yeah, I'm planning on getting him back. Because
that's the exact kind of stuff he does.
Oh, I know. I love it too. He's so good at that.
It's the polar opposite of how I do things, but it is exactly how he does things.
But just how many emotional reactive decisions your brain tries to make you make in the course of a trading day is just mind-blowing. And once you start to recognize when those thoughts are coming in, like you can make some really good, you can pick up some good ground really quickly.
Yeah.
When you start recognizing that.
I think with stuff like that in emotionality, I think a big part of it is developing a life framework, not a trading framework, but a life framework for thinking. And the reason why I say that is because like in the beginning, the reason why we'll have emotions control a lot of things is because it's a visceral response to something that we haven't really, you know, managed before. Mm-hmm. But what ends up happening is you start to build like mental calluses. And it's like the same thing for those that have been in combat, right? Like the first time you get shot at, you might sit there and be like, oh shit, you know, that's pretty close. And then over time, you get to the point where you can decipher the difference between cracks, whizzes, pops, snaps. And you might hear something come by and you're like, yo, that dude's fucking blind. He's not anywhere near me. And then it's a completely different response. But
interesting.
It comes when you can get into like the nuance and you're not reacting to this life-threatening scenario at face value and simply saying, gross pattern getting shot at. Have to do something. And once you understand the nuance there, you can move in a couple clicks and actually analyze things as they're happening. To your point, when you're on the plane, you start feeling turbulence, the first response, fear, a lot of other things. But then if you didn't like immediately go to like rip the door open, no. Right? So you're like, no. Well, this would not help us.
No, it was first acknowledging that fear was there and then trying to figure out what I could do about it.
Exactly. And it's the same exact thing, I think, with response to emotional thinking, because your emotional response is going to be typically very fast and it's going to be imprecise and it's going to be based on typically less information And it's a visceral response. But then as soon as you, exactly as you did on the plane, as soon as you can receive the input, understand the response, and then start cycling on it. The Marine Corps, we use a process like Boyd's OODA loop. It's the same thing. And the idea behind that is just, again, it's a framework of thinking of things that helps a lot to start slowing down the emotional response. Because the cool part is, if you get good at, here's an example. If you show me somebody that when they're driving to work, they get pissed off because whatever reason, you know, during the commute, it's easy to get upset. But if you show me that person that over their 50 minute commute, they're pissed off 2-3 times, I literally will guarantee you, I will see it in their trading. I guarantee you that that is going to be an emotional trader. Guarantee it.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. It's building a different way of perceiving the world and information, just carrying it over into trading as just another vector that you're deploying this way you think.
Another example I had written out here is, have you ever seen the movie Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, at the very end when they're in the gunfight, and I think that scene right there just really kind of shows like it's just a great example of the wisdom, the thought process behind deliberate actions. Like you watch him as he shoots basically every bad guy in the bar. He takes his time. He lines up his sights, squeezes the trigger, moves on to the next one. And everybody else in that room is frantically, blindly trying to pull out their guns and just fire off bullets as much as they can. And they're hitting nothing. Like that to me is the fucking example of that right there. You mentioned combat. I just thought that was just such a well done scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because I'll talk to traders, and one of the first things I always try to do is detect hyperbole in language. I look for people that overreact to things. Like you should have seen people today, right? People are literally like, oh my God, the market's crashing. Or after it was down like 1.6%, they're like, wow, what a, it's a massive rejection from this. I'm just like, do yourself a huge favor. It's okay to look at the market movements. Get rid of the adjectives. You need none of them. Just completely drop the adjective. Massive movement. Don't need it. Doesn't have to be there yet.
What do they call that? What was that called with the judgment values?
Value judgments. Exactly.
Value judgments. That's right.
And
yes.
Yep. That's exactly correct. You're taking things and you're passing on to them your perception of it built on whatever it is. For a lot of those kinds of people, it's actually baked on inexperience. And the way like Marcus Aurelius was really good about this is he talked a lot about breaking things down into their core concepts, right? And talking about it as it is, like really expensive wine is fermented grape. Sounds a lot less sexy than this, you know, $400 bottle of wine. And so it's like, especially for newer traders that are trying to wrangle their emotions, I think a big part of that that you can learn from the Stoics is not to suppress emotion. I always reject that idea to think that like be a robot is complete. It's complete bullshit because you are human, but it's also to not allow emotions to be the dictator of thought.
That so, is the key.
Yeah, and exactly.
I think that the definitions here is what kind of gets people, because there's the word Stoic has come to mean something completely different than the philosophy or practitioner of the philosophy. Now it just means somebody who doesn't show emotions. They're very reserved, right? And so that gives people this false idea that Stoicism is not showing emotions. Well, it's not that at all. It's about understanding your emotions, understanding that there's reactions to them, but not giving in to the temptation to react to them. I think that's the key.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cool part about it is that it's something that's built over time. That's the cool part. So in the beginning, again, it's really easy to be excessively emotional, or it's really easy to let emotions take too much of a hold in our thought process. But you can absolutely navigate it over time and build a different framework for receiving information. That again, it's one of the easiest things I think for traders to do. I always tell them, like, if you show me elation in a trader when they're very happy, given enough time, I will show you despair. You'll see it. And one of the easiest things you can do as a trader is to disallow extremes. You're still going to have emotions. You're still going to have, like today. Today was actually a really good day, but I was a little grumpy that the crude oil position that I put on didn't move as much as I thought it should have. But it still was good. So I don't look at it and start jumping for joy that it's offsetting some of the other positions that I have that are, you know, NASDAQ that was down or whatever. So it's a function of just looking at things pragmatically and saying like, this is up, this is up, this is down, this is down, and just running through it, that not being elated or upset at any of them.
So what do you do when you start to feel one of those extremes then? How do you snap yourself out? How do you interrupt that cycle?
It's a bit of a non-answer because I have to be completely honest with you. I haven't felt emotional extremes genuinely for a really, even when my dad died, I did not feel like this giant emotional extreme. So it would be super disingenuous for me to frame it as like, this is what I would do, because I think I've started cultivating this feeling, like this general mindset back in college.
Here, let's do it this way then. You're in a trade, something happens, it goes in your favor by a significant amount really quickly, and you start to feel joy. What happens at that point?
Being completely honest, like, I don't feel joy.
No, you don't even feel it. Wow.
I genuinely don't care. Like, I literally just don't care.
Is that one of the, because you talked about calluses, and that's something I think I've talked about in the past, where I feel like I burnt out a lot of my emotion centers, where like when I used to feel a lot of joy.
And I think, I think that's where it comes from. So that one, I can definitely talk about the progression because like everybody, I used to go through that. Even when I had a small account, seeing a trade that was up $500, I'd be like, oh shit. Like this is,
let's go.
This is exactly
right.
And I started realizing very early on that when things were not going well, I could easily read between the lines and thinking, like, I could feel my heart rate speeding up. Like, I could feel physical responses. Mm-hmm. And then that's immediately, like, I just noticed that pattern was happening. So then I literally just stopped myself from when I would see a trade going well or not going well. The only thing that I genuinely focus on is the application of my approach. That's it. Mm-hmm. And I don't hide, because this is actually something I drastically differ from Richard. I just had him on the podcast again.
Yeah, I saw that.
Not too long ago. And I love Richard. I love talking to
Rich
him.
Too.
But he and I have very different approaches. That's actually why I like having him on so much, because I understand that the way that I look at things is probably very different than a lot of people and maybe not super relatable at this point. And his, I can totally see its applicability to just about everybody. But for example,
longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
One of the things Richard talks about is like essentially getting rid of the concept of a loss on a trade and just talking about, was it a lucrative trade, is which what
yes.
he calls it.
Yes.
And for me, I don't get rid of the loss. In my mind, I look at the loss. I acknowledge that this trade is a realized losing position. I don't care. I don't care if it's a realized losing position, as long as this realized losing position occurred in the application of a strategy that I know generally works.
Well, so it's very similar. It's still the same thing. Then, yeah, you just.
But the difference is I look at the loss. I look at the loss. I acknowledge the loss. I don't pretend that it's not a loss. I don't, in my mind, play any sort of manipulation like, oh, there's no losing trades as long as you follow your strategy. Like, no, there is a fucking losing trade. I can see it. It's a number. This is a quantitative thing that is undeniable. Well, so that's the only difference.
But then, I guess in Rich's defense, he doesn't want you looking at any one trade anyway. He wants you looking at the whole thing as a process. And he's trying to take the He's trying to take those feelings that you feel of joy and elation or despair when you lose and shift that to the process instead, right?
Now, and again, even that, there's danger. And again, I want to be abundantly clear. I love Richard's approach, and I think it works well for a lot of people, because I don't think for most people it's easy to go from this emotional cycle that you're on to kind of this more even-keeled, genuinely do not care if it's a winning or losing position, because I know in the aggregate it's going to win. It takes a long time to get to that confidence. So again, I understand what he's doing for sure. Yeah, and I it. But the problem is, if we're not looking at individual trades and how they go, it is real hard to then optimize a system.
Yeah. Especially, well, okay. One more Rich defense here. I would say looking, you still have to look at the lousy or lucrative trade. You have to look at the trade in order to determine whether it's lucrative or lousy. So you still have to analyze it. You can't just say, oh, I took a trade, it was a loss, I'll just shut my computer off and never look at that day again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And again, the only main departure is that I don't try to shield.
You're not
I don't
changing try to shield the names. Myself. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't try to shield myself at all from looking at a trade and analyzing the realized P&L and acknowledging this, because I have no problem telling myself this was a good trade that lost money. I can say that every single time. That's okay.
And that was something that I've recently come around to, I think was probably one of the biggest leaks in my trading process was acceptance portion. We talked a little bit about that, but not being able to accept a loss or accept that a trade was wrong has cost me a lot of money over the years of trying to do this. So that's been one of the things that I've really tried to focus on. In fact, I actually write out like four mantras of the things that I'm going to be today. Today, I'm going to be patient, or I'm going to be responsible, or I'm going to be, you know, but accepting has made its way on there. I will accept the results of my trades, of my day, of everything. And if I don't find myself accepting that, then that's the sign to me that I need to just shut the thing off and go away for a day.
I think that's one of the cool things about exploring different perspectives, right? Because that's so different than me.
Yeah.
It's so different than me. Yeah. Because the idea of even getting to such an emotional state that I can't deploy anymore is literally crazy to me. I totally understand it though. And I can see how that happens. And I think that having the kind of discipline to do that is massive, because the idea of like revenge trading, I've had that before.
Yeah.
I've definitely have had that.
That's before. I think that's what it stems from. You don't want to admit that your trade was wrong.
Right. Yeah. Now, one of the things that I've used for stuff like that, I don't know if you've thought about it this way, but I think one of the reasons why people get into revenge trading, well, it comes from typically two things as far as I can see. One, the process of losing money and trying to get the money back. I would probably argue that's the most common.
Yeah.
And then there's another version where it's like, we thought our idea was right, and we can't accept that whether or not the idea itself is right doesn't matter. It's what price is doing that matters.
Yep.
But to me, I look at it as any sort of position that I put on, I look at it as a probabilistic analysis. I never say blank is going to do blank, because again, cannot control that. I have no dog in that fight. Mm-hmm. But I can look at things based on a breadth of experience and say, I think this is more likely to happen than that. And because of that probabilistic assessment, I'm going to structure things a certain way. And the only other thing I'll add to that is one of the things I think has taken me a long time to adopt as a trader, that the sooner somebody can adopt, the better off they are, is that I genuinely have no problem looking at something, saying I'm wrong, and then going the other way. So the only way that that can happen is if a person is detaching their ego from the analysis that's conducted. And it's simply saying, based on the breadth of evidence, what I know right now, this is my probabilistic assessment. If something else happens, the probabilities played out wrong, my probabilistic assessment was wrong, whatever it is, changed. I have new information. I'm going to do something different now based on this new information. So the main point of all that is to try and detach your identity, your ego, your confidence from the analysis in and of itself of an individual occurrence and look at it more over the long run.
Dude, I freaking love that. I love that, because how often do we look at something and we say, I think it's going here, but nowhere are we ever acknowledging the fact that it's a probability. I think it's, just throwing that in there gives you an out in your mind to not have to cling to that. We talked about like the what do we call it? Reserve clause. It's almost like a reserve clause for the markets.
That's exactly correct. That's it's literally exactly what it is.
I freaking love that. I'm going to start doing that. In fact, I might even start writing percentages out on my charts too when I take a trade.
I mean, the cool part with options is that's exactly what I do.
Yeah.
Because with options, you can look at the probability of something hitting different points just based on options pricing.
Yep.
Which, fun fact, stock traders can do that too, even if you don't use options. You can still look at options for their probabilistic properties because that's, if you think about options, that's literally all they are. They're probabilities that different things are going to happen in different ways. So that's actually something I think is interesting for stock traders to leverage some of the predictive capabilities of options. Not that like predictive in that there's a crystal ball and you know what's going to happen, but it helps you quantify things objectively. Because if I look at support and resistance on a chart, I could say, I feel like there's a 65% chance of this going here versus there. Maybe I'll use an average daily range for some sort of volatility input. And that's actually really successful, by the way. You can do that. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you can do is literally just say, I'm going to be in this trade, I think, for 44 days. You can open up an options chain, go to 44 days, look at where you plotted support and resistance, look at the corresponding strike prices, and look at the probabilities. And again, those probabilities typically are off of a neutral density. So it's not going to account for the drift that you think might be there. Or again, like the slight edge in your analysis that might not be priced in, but it's going to be priced in based off of market consensus, which is typically pretty smart.
I think we learned that from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when they do the poll the audience.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Collective intelligence.
Unless they hate you.
Be a lot better.
And then they just send you down the wrong way.
Do they ever do that?
I don't know, but I tell you what, it depends on who's there. If it's somebody that they don't like, I would happily troll the fuck out of them.
Did you ever see Norm Macdonald do his?
I haven't. There was...
He was fucking dude, really good.
There was one dude that I really, really liked that he didn't use anything the whole time. And then for the $1 million, he's like, I'm going to call my dad.
Yeah, to tell him he's winning $1 million.
And he's just like, he's like, I don't need your help. I'm just letting you know I'm going to win $1 million. Like, just
that's so cool.
Great gangster.
Should drop the mic after.
Dude, that was like, what a gangster move. Because he didn't even forecast that he was doing that, right? He didn't let anybody know that's the purpose of the call.
You know, the worst part is the networks probably hated that guy too, because there was no drama. He just sat there and answered the questions.
Yeah. I mean, that part added a lot of entertainment because that still comes up now. And that's what? That clip's from like the 80s or 90s, I think.
It can't be that old, can it?
Really?
When did Who Wants to Be a Millionaire come out? That came out in like.
That's a great question.
Was that 2000s or was that 90s?
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now for us.
Let's see. Well, we got dead air here. See if I can figure out something else to ask you about.
There we go. 1999. I just got 99. In there. Just really? The cusp. Yeah, 1999. Carpenter proceeded to advance to the $1 million question without using any lifelines. He then used his phone a friend to call his father, not for help, but rather to tell him he was going to win the game.
I love that he was a carpenter, too.
That's so awesome. I just love that so much.
That guy's a stoic.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the whole time, that dude was cold.
Dude, so how did you get into this? How did you even find Stoicism? Was that through the Marine Corps or was that through something else?
I think the Marine Corps happens to value a lot of Stoic principles in its officers, right? So if it's super hot, I'm not going to tell you, especially if the dudes are there. I'm not going to tell you. I'm just going to fucking sweat. If it's super cold, I'm not going to have a beanie on. I'm going to sit there. I'm going to be fucking cold, but the dudes aren't going to know. And a lot of it comes down to setting an example for the guys when things are really, really fucking shitty. Same thing like when we do the long hikes and rock marches and stuff like that. During the break points, we normally let the dudes sit down, grab a bite to eat, normally have like 5-10 minute break, you know, depending on how far we're going. And like most of us, we don't take our shit off because we want them to know, one, I care more about you, two, this is possible without that break. So you get a break, it should give you an extra little bit of wind in your sails because I'm going to show you by example, you don't need that and it's okay.
Yeah, now they've lost the ability to say, nobody can do this when they just watched you do it without taking the same breaks.
It's a big deal, man. We do this kind of stuff all over the place. And the Marine Corps is really, really big into leaders leading from the front. Mm-hmm. And the implicit task there is you have to set a perpetual example because everybody is always looking at you when you're in the front. So you cannot show weakness. I remember during my TBS class, we didn't know this, but our instructor, at one point during the course, literally the entire bottom of his foot, like all the skin came off. He had an infection and he took 0 days off. None of us knew during the instruction. None of us knew. It came out at the very end and he showed us a picture and it's literally raw flesh on the entire bottom of his foot.
Jesus.
And in the morning he would get with the corpsman, you know, our favorite Navy people that hook us up, bro. They keep us moving. And they essentially like put a bunch of shit on the bottom of his foot so that he could go do the job. And I literally, none of us knew.
Wow.
So I think it started there. I didn't start getting into
that. Wasn't happening in the Navy, by the way.
A slightly different culture.
Yeah, a little bit.
But I didn't start getting into like really reading and understanding the nuance. I read Meditations in college half-heartedly, didn't understand it. And it was during COVID, actually, because I've told this story before, but I was going through, I've never really felt depression before, but I actually was depressed during COVID. I never felt anything like that before. And it was for a mix of different reasons that nobody cares about. But the main thing is I started looking for different perspectives. And that's when I started reading a lot about Stoicism, as I thought that it helped me a lot gain different perspectives. Like one of the Stoic practices that I do every single day now is visualize my death. Every day, mm-hmm. I visualize my death. And I think of it in exquisite detail.
I haven't gotten to that chapter yet.
And it's a strange process the first few times, but I do that every day. Another thing that I do every day.
We're going to go back to that one. Is that to get over that fear of dying?
It's not so much to get over the fear of dying, but it's to acknowledge you're going to die. Yeah. Most of us live our lives in a way where dying is deferred. And we're thinking about it as, oh, this is hopefully for most of us, something that'll happen in 30, 40, 50 years, right? Further down the line. But there is very much a reality that it can happen sooner. So then the idea is if you truly conceptualize your death, you then think a little bit more carefully about how you spend your day. And that's the idea.
Okay, that makes more sense. So you don't take anything for granted kind of thing.
You try to take less. And it's actually funny because that's the second Stoic practice that I use on a daily basis. I don't remember the name for the exercise, but essentially you do something to make you appreciate what you have. Mm-hmm. So one that I do often is like, if I'm taking a shower, I'll close my eyes the entire shower. I just will pretend that I have no vision because it doesn't impact anything. Yeah. It's slightly inconvenient in the shower. But it gives me time to like think about it. Like, fuck, man. Like, imagine not having vision, right? And I told you before we started, right now I have the herniated disc, right? Mm-hmm. So my mobility is really bad. I'm in pain a lot now, but I still have vision. It's pretty cool, right? I'm still happy to have vision. So yeah, I'm bummed that my back is fucked up and it's causing me problems, but it gives you some context about these different things. So yeah, those are like two of my most commonly used Stoic practices for sure.
It's kind of funny how the shower ends up being the spot where we do a lot of those things. Like I know a lot of people mm-hmm. do the cold showers. I can't do the cold showers, especially in Illinois.
I have a cold tub.
But what I have started doing, and this is kind of like a compromise between the two, is when I finish my shower, I shut everything off and I don't towel off until I finish squeegeeing off everything inside. Mm. So I have to stand and be present with that cold, wet feeling.
Yeah, definitely
makes you appreciate that dryness as soon as you're out of there.
It does. Yeah. And that also builds a little bit of discipline too.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Because I think that that's a really important factor. I have small discipline challenges that I do every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just because I view discipline as something like it's a habit that can either be bolstered or weakened. And I think about, like, for example, if I wanted to check my phone right now for something, sometimes say if it's something non-pressing, then I'll set a timer for 2 minutes. You can check it in 2 minutes. You can't check it right now. That's it.
Just a little thing. Just a little something.
Just little tiny things like that, man. And I think you can start so small and then you can build over time. Like right now I'm still only eating one meal a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that started from just essentially trying a diet. And then it has become something that I do now every single day. And I actually really like it. I feel much better this way.
I prefer eating one big meal.
Yeah. And I found out a lot of the dudes in my family are like that. My uncle's like that.
See, most of the people I know are the other way around. They need to eat like every 20 minutes or they fall apart.
That's the thing, is they don't need to, but they think they do.
Well, you see those people that shake and they... blood sugar gets out of whack.
Well, it's literally just because it's a short-term problem, right? Mm-hmm. Even when your blood sugar goes out of whack, because I definitely will have low blood sugar at periods if I'm not thoughtful, but your body adapts to the circumstance over time.
I say that wouldn't be very good if if you were like on Naked and Afraid or something, just shaking out you, there for 21 days.
I guess a lot of them inherently start becoming, you know, one meal a day people.
Zero whether meals a day.
Whether they want to eat zero meals for 4 days.
Matt, we were talking about the discipline thing. There's something I wanted to piggyback on that, and I can't remember what it was now.
Because
you're talking about the little micro discipline things that you do.
Yeah.
There was something in there. I lost it.
I call them stoic challenges.
Stoic challenges.
Yep.
No, that's what it was. Okay. The whole point of this is not the whole point. Let me back up there again.
You're doing great.
Smart ass. I hate the word discipline. I hate thinking that I have to do something because of discipline. But it's a much more palatable for me to think of it as a test. Can I pass the test of waiting 2 minutes to check my phone? Can I pass the test that the markets are going to take my stop and see if I want to re-enter? Can I pass the test?
I love that.
For me, that works way better than discipline. Discipline does nothing for me. Doing something just for the sake of doing it.
Right, because it's almost like rebellion.
Yes. It's a lot of that. Yeah.
Yep.
And I don't know. There's some value in there is out of whack probably, but...
But I think that's fine, right? Because that's the nature of discipline, is to find how to get yourself
to apply it.
It is.
Yes.
Exactly. Because I think a lot of people mistakenly, I call myself the most disciplined, undisciplined person, because on a daily basis, I'm having all sorts of negotiations with myself that I always end up losing to myself. But like, I'm always trying to find some sort of out. It's insane. Like going in the cold tub. It's like, well, you know, if you do the cold tub now, it's not properly timed, and then it'll slow down how much you're going to warm up at the gym. It's
2 reps is good enough. Yeah, no.
It's this nonstop negotiation that I always have to shut the fuck down. And it's just like, no, bitch, like we're doing it right now just because fuck you. And the way that I look at it, it's the way that I always frame it is like, do I want to be the kind of man that can't or can or does do blank? I don't know what it is about me. It just gets my ire. But so like, for example, if I have to get up early in the morning and I don't feel like it, the alarm goes off and there's not really a pressing function, right? Like I don't have a call. I don't have something I have to do and I don't feel like getting up. The question I'll ask myself is like, do I want to be the kind of man that when the alarm goes off, I can't get up? Like, is that who I'm going to be?
And that's who I am. What it is. I don't want to be that guy, but
I don't know who it is. Like, I don't know why it's like that. I think it's because I hold older generations in such high regard. I look at people like my grandpa and like those kind of generations.
Do you have a vision of like who that person is that you're trying to not be?
Me. Yeah. I just think of it as myself. Like I frame it that way. And as soon as I think of it that way, then it's literally transformative to me. I don't know what it is about the phrasing. I don't know why it works. I don't understand the psychology behind it. I stumbled across it at one point when it was during COVID and I was being like real sloppy with myself. I was being super undisciplined. And I just started asking myself that question in different ways and don't know what it is, but.
Well, there's a version of that I do that I kind of like too, but it's the way I start my mornings with when I sit down at the trading desk, what trader am I going to be today? And I write out several things that I'm going to work on today. Today, I'm going to be a trader who only enters with limits. Doesn't use market orders. Or today I'm going to be a trader who doesn't move his limits and chase price. Today I'm going to be a trader who, and it's all that. It's just that phrase. And then whatever thing I want to work on. And I work on that thing until I don't need to work on it anymore. And then I pick a new one. But it's kind of similar. That. This is who I want to be today. And I'm going to be that person.
It's super similar.
And what's great about it is even if I take losses and have a losing day, I can still look at the day and be like, well, at least I wasn't a chicken shit. You know, I said I was going to take 3 losses. I did the thing I said I was going to be. I was not afraid. Yep. I was not afraid to lose.
I like that. I like that a lot. For me, it would be like, do you want to be the trader that puts on a trade and immediately goes against you 100% of the time? That would be mine.
Yours is almost like the opposite of that. It's the person you don't want to be.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny that that's what gets you motivated. That's kind of interesting.
I think I've been in a aversion-based person my whole life.
Yeah.
Like, fear of failure is way more of a motivator for me than striving for success or like the feeling of success. So yeah, it falls direct in line with whatever the base of my psychology is.
We didn't get to it, but I have to ask it because we're talking about some of the other sides or the potential pitfalls of something like stoicism. You had your example, and then there was one that I wanted to bring up that I never really got a chance to ask you about, but a lot of it is about living in the moment, like circling the present. You're ignore the past, ignore the future, focus on today and now, because that's what you can control. How do you reconcile that with long-term planning or thinking about the future or how that relates?
Yeah, I always viewed, and again, I think that's one of the things about stoicism. It requires a little bit of nuanced application because I view that as overcorrection for a standard behavior that then would be, again, moderated over time. So, because I agree with you, because the Stoics essentially would tell you to just live on the day. And if that were the case, like if I knew I was going to die tomorrow, you had better believe your boy's balling the fuck out.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to spend everything. I'll definitely still leave my wife plenty of money, but I'm still going to spend a good bit of money.
5 years worth is good. That's enough time to find someone else.
Yeah. Yep.
You don't have to buy him a boat.
And so I start like, I think of it as it's trying to get people, it's an overcorrection because it's so easy to be so the opposite that it's creating a very focal point that then can be adjusted over time. Because again, like if you think of somebody like Marcus Aurelius, he doesn't think that, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing about him that actually thinks of focusing only on today. But I'm sure for somebody like him that's planning the course of an empire, it probably is very difficult to think about today and only today. So that's how I think about it. It's kind of getting people to be able to do that.
The tasks that you have to do today may be planning for the future, I suppose, too. It doesn't necessarily have to be that whatever your actions are only affecting right now. Like, that's just what you're doing right now. Right now, I am planning for my future.
Right. Yeah. And that's literally a fantastic point. Yeah. Because I think a lot of stuff that I find as I read Stoicism is it's like the same thing when you read a lot of religion. You kind of have to determine if you're going to be a letter reader or if you're going to try to interpolate some. And there's pros and cons to both, not advocating for either outright. But I tend to try to think about the message, what it's trying to tell me, and then applying it to me. Because that's the other thing is like different people will apply things to themselves slightly differently based on your, you know, disposition. Again, we found one very interesting between you and I that you talk about who you want to be and I talk about who I don't want to be. And that's a very clear difference in what motivates both of us.
Mm-hmm. Also, if I was following the letter of the law, I couldn't have my favorite cup anymore because you're not allowed to have a favorite cup.
Right. Because you might lose it or it might be broken.
All right. What is the new website? What's the new YouTube? Where can people find the new stuff that you're doing now? Is any of the links changed? Do I need to go through and redo everything that you've been on?
The old links have changed. You don't have to redo anything. It doesn't matter.
Okay. All right.
Because the old website will redirect to the new one. I still have that domain. Yeah. The only real change is the YouTube channel now is not ES Invest, it's Outlier Trading. Most of my handles will be that at this point.
Twitter, same still, or?
I don't even know what my Twitter is, to be honest.
All right, I'll verify it before I link it there.
Yeah, sorry.
And then books, if people want to learn more about Stoicism, you got me the Beginner's Guide to Stoicism. That's the one that started me out. What are some other ones that people can check out?
I'm pulling up my Kindle right now. I think there's probably three. There's three books that I think cover it really well, and it's definitely not starting with Meditations. I actually think Meditations is kind of like a varsity level move.
Meditations is, it's like the journal of Marcus Aurelius, right? It's not necessarily.
He wrote it for himself. So it's everything that you read in there literally is designed to be interpreted. Well, it wasn't designed to be interpreted by anybody. It was for him. So I think like Meditations is a great book, but it is definitely not a starter book.
Yeah, it's not the first one you need to pick up.
Yeah, I think the one you already mentioned is the first one. I think the next one would be The Stoic Challenge. That's a really good way to start. Cause it's funny the way that like that book will resonate heavily with you.
Yeah.
Because the way that you talk about setting up things as like tests, like discipline as tests, that's what the Stoic Challenge is all about, is like life is testing you and you're going to see how you respond. So that's exactly the entire purpose of that book. It's fantastic.
Oh man, big fan of that.
Yeah, I actually think that one probably should be your next read. And then the third one I would go with, I think anything with Ryan Holiday is okay. He's not my personal flavor, but I think he's good for people that are looking for something that's kind of distilled down a bit more. I'm very much like a direct source kind of guy. Like I don't want somebody interpreting it for me. I want to do that.
It's kind of tough with Stoicism when the original texts have been lost, though.
And it's real difficult because then it's like, how many layers has it been interpreted by who with what ideas? But the one thing I can say very positively about Ryan Holiday, and I like his work, I've read most of his books. I think that's mostly what he does is like really approachable to people because it breaks down a lot of the more esoteric ideas into things that I would argue a little easier to consume. So that would be like the third branch. Anything by Ryan Holiday is probably good.
Is he the one who wrote like the series like Courage and
yeah, exactly. Okay. That's exactly correct. Yeah. That's him.
All right.
Yep. That's him.
All right. Well, shit, Eric, man, it's good catching up with you, dude. We'll have to do this again.
I know. It's been a minute.
Are you still doing the GameStop things on YouTube?
Yeah, I'm still talking about GameStop here and there. It's a bit of a mix now with like what's going on and like what's topical. But right now I'm literally doing a video pretty much every single day that's just talking about something from the market. And then I do a live stream every day at 5 p.m. Pacific time, literally in an hour.
Oh, you do them all. I didn't know you're doing those every. I thought they all moved to Friday. Or is that just the beginners?
The beginners is Friday.
Okay.
So I started coming up with slightly different themes so that people can kind of have, you know, like a focal point if they don't want to join all of them. So yeah, so I'm doing that. And then I still have standard video releases. So kind of like more my thematic evergreen style content is every Saturday still. That's not changed for years. And yeah, that is kind of the same.
All right. Well, make sure you check all that stuff out. We'll have links in the show notes for people who don't remember what the links are, because I don't.
Fair.
But they'll be there. Click on them. Like, share, subscribe, all that good shit. Have a great day, guys.
Slap that 5-star rating like Iran is slapping Israel with ICBMs.
Did they actually hit anything?
Who knows? Probably. I think there's actually a few people dead, but I think it was from a more the localized fragments attack.
Falling, I think, was most
I think it's. Yeah. I think it's a more localized attack. Yeah. They're going to have a hard time.
I think we should have waited a week before we put this out. Slap that 5-star rating like Israel just smoked the Ayatollah.
Yeah, there's that's what I said. There's a fucking million of them that you could do. I cannot believe that you would abandon that.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only, does not constitute financial or investment advice, and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.